Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. And I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we start off with EP Press in conversation with Sean Collins about canvassing for the Sanctuary City Resolution in Troy. Then on Reclaiming History, Livonia Mallory will be speaking with Dr. Vince Bantu, who talks about St. Augustine. After that, Peter Savio speaks with Kevin Bailey of High Peak Solar on this week's segment of Climate Matters. Then on Labor Talk, Willie Terry brings us part two of Revolution or Reform at the Black and Puerto Rican Legislators Caucus. And then to close out the show, Cassidy McCabe speaks with Cherokee Grimes to discuss the spirit of the Suffragettes Summer Festival.
But first, let's have some local headlines. On Thursday, Congressman Paul Tonko is poised to get up close and look at a project to revitalize a neighborhood in Schenectady. $25 million will be used to develop the city's Lower State Street neighborhood.
A proposal from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo would provide on-campus child care for single parents attending community college. The governor said Thursday that he'll ask lawmakers to approve a pilot program for up to 400 students at campuses around the state. Single parents participating in the program would also have access to tutoring and help applying to four-year schools.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM, The Sanctuary.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004. We start off today's show with a check-in on what activists have been doing in support of the Troy Sanctuary City Resolution.
This is Elizabeth Press for this week's check-in with local immigration issues. Today we are joined by Sean Collins. He is the Vice President of the Troy Area Labor Council and works with the Troy Sanctuary Campaign. Today, he's here to talk about the canvassing effort that's around the Troy Sanctuary City Resolution. So, welcome, first of all.
Thanks for having me.
And can you tell me about this canvassing effort that is currently taking place in Troy? What are you all doing? You've been out on the streets a couple weekends, so you have a couple more coming up.
Yeah, so the idea behind the canvas came up immediately after the resolution that David Bissever introduced was tabled, because both the mayor and other folks, including Councilmember T.J. Kennedy, said that they wanted to see more discussion at the community level. So there have been a variety of different neighborhood meetings, but T.J. hasn't organized a meetings in his neighborhood. So, you know, we wanted to be sure to talk to everybody across the city. So in lieu of that, we were like, well, fine, we'll just take it to the doorstep of his constituents and see what they think. So, we've done it now two weekends in a row. And it's been great. We're going out basically saying this is a resolution that largely, affirms city policy and procedures on inquiring about one's documented status. This is something that Albany, Hudson, Kingston, New York City, other cities across the country have done. It's in compliance with the Attorney General's guidelines on sanctuary cities. And, you know, your council member thinks that, you know, that you were opposed to this. And we want to prove him wrong. And based on the conversations we've had, they've been overwhelmingly supportive for the folks that are home. The response has been incredible.
So for people that don't know what canvassing is, you're literally going door to door and knocking on people's door and engaging with them.
Yeah, we have clipboards and pens and, several layers because it's very cold out. Yeah, we're not relying on voter lists. We're not relying on talking to just registered voters. We're hitting every door in the neighborhood and, blindly knocking on them and saying, hi, my name's Sean. I'm with the Troy Sanctuary Campaign. We're here to talk to you about protecting immigrants that live here in your neighborhood, in your community. Have you heard at all about this? And yeah, I would say we've knocked on more than 400 doors across his district. And like I said, for the folks who are home and come to the door, overwhelmingly positive.
And do people know about the resolution, or are you educating from ground zero?
There is definitely some awareness, but yeah, there is some education. We make a point to talk about this isn't just about undocumented or documented immigrants, but it's about combating a narrative that is out there that they're not welcome here in these communities, and that can apply to an undocumented person. Or it can also apply to, the student here on a visa at RPI who doesn't feel safe leaving campus and going out in the community. And so this resolution is, you know, both the start of a broader conversation, hopefully around immigration issues in this region, but also to say that, like, we welcome you here in our community. You know, like, you shouldn't have to shelter in place.
Where have you been? You said you've been in T.J. Kennedy's district. Is that South Troy?
Yeah, so South, it's District 6. It's South Troy. It's, you know, everything, you know, the President's Streets south of Jackson Street. To the South Troy Bridge. So we've done that whole neighborhood, that sort of that hill up towards Hudson Valley. So we did Stowe Farm, where T.J. Kennedy lives himself. It's Stowe Farm, that's what they call it on the Troy Neighborhood Action Council website. And then we also did Albia, and which is off of Pauling Avenue over by Sacred Heart.
And you even knocked on his neighbor's door?
We did knock on his neighbor's door. Apparently, I forget his neighbor's name, but apparently, you know, he's tried to talk to TJ about this, and, you know, he's a supporter. You know, just down the block on Stowe Ave, you know, just on the block, I spoke to someone out there, you know, who said, you know, my wife or fiance is, you know, is an immigrant. And he's like immediately like took the petition from me, the clipboard from me, and brought it inside to have his family sign as well.
And what is this petition that you're talking about?
Oh, yeah. So the petition is directed at the mayor, Mayor Madden, and TJ, urging them to come out in support of this resolution. We're hoping, we understand that the resolution is going to be untabled and brought up for discussion at the next city council meeting, March 7th, Thursday, March 7th. And yeah, we want to put it to a vote. You know, when these things just are allowed to fester, doesn't allow folks to make a decision. And it's just, you know, one way or the other, we want to know where folks stand so that we can make it an issue later on, or we can address the issue later on. But we think there's value in knowing where folks stand on the matter, and it's sitting, you know, it's sitting tabled or, you know, put in a drawer somewhere. It means it's an, you know, it's an open-ended question. And as a resolution, it's largely more of a symbolic gesture. And so passing it would not materially change, you know, an immigrant's conditions here, you know, in Troy. But it would send a message that, like, actually this community is far more welcoming than maybe meets the eye, maybe what I encounter on the news. But to say it to just for folks that vote no and vote it down, if it was voted down, hopefully it's not, it wouldn't materially change anything. Unfortunately, it would just reaffirm what they believe to be the case.
And on that note, I mean, I recently spoke with T.J. Kennedy on this show, mm-hmm. and part of his resistance or hesitation in supporting it seemed to be that creating this resolution would create a sense of false hope amongst our immigrant community, and also that there aren't so many immigrants to put our time and resources into this issue. Do you have a response to either of those for him?
Yeah, I mean, on the latter point, you know, we can look at census data, and yeah, it would say that like more, like something like 4 to 7% of Rensselaer County residents are immigrants. But it's also important to recognize like that's often underreported because folks don't offer that up to a census employee. But even if it is only 4%, like that 4%. Still feels a certain way. And we know this from having talked to those immigrant communities. You know, in talking to them about it, they don't feel a sense of false hope. They understand this is part of a larger discussion about changing the conversation and changing people's minds and also humanizing the discussion, I think, more than it gets talked about. Because, yeah, it's what happens when you talk about it in terms of numbers, but not people's experiences. You know, what happened to Delilah Yeend, yeah, she's just one of many who was caught in this dragnet. But she's also a working mother, single mother who was taking care of her kids and was torn away from her family. It's not false hope. You know, I think it's important to her. It's important to the other immigrants across the state in Kingston and Albany and the other immigrants, you know, rights organizations that have organized around this that are following the leadership of immigrant and undocumented folks. It's important to them. So we should take their word for it.
Sean Collins, is there anything else that you want to add on this?
We are going to be canvassing again both Saturday and Sunday.
The 23rd and 24th.
23rd and 24th, and then also the following weekend, which I believe is like the 2nd and 3rd of March before the March 7th council meeting. We haven't totally decided on which neighborhoods we want to go to, but we're particularly interested in going into Griswold Heights. We feel like that's usually an overlooked corner of the city, like the other, and so are the other housing authority projects as well. So we want to go there and we want to talk to those residents. And then, yeah, the hope is, you know, to deliver this petition on March 7th to the city council meeting to TJ himself.
And if people want to join you for either of these upcoming canvassing efforts, how can they get in touch with you?
TroySanctuaryCampaign@gmail.com.
TroySanctuaryCampaign@gmail.com. Thank you, Sean Collins, for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Elizabeth Press interviewing Sean Collins about canvassing or going door to door to support the Troy Sanctuary City resolution.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOC 105.3 FM. Next, on Reclaiming History, Livonia Mallory speaks with Dr. Vince Bantu. Dr. Bantu is the founder of the Meacham Memhara Haymanot, a graduate-level theological education to African-American, ethnic minority, and low-income communities in a contextualized and affordable manner. He holds an MA and PhD in Semitic and Egyptian languages from the Catholic University of America. In honor of Black History Month, he'll be discussing St. Augustine, A Boy in the Hood.
Once again, we have another Reclaiming History segment on WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy. I have a very special guest with me today. We're going to be talking about St. Augustine, A Boy from the Hood. My guest is Dr. Vincent Bantu. Dr. Bantu, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much, Livonia. It's a blessing to be here.
Listen, you're a returnee, man. This is the second time you've been on with us, and we are so glad you agreed to come on once again.
Oh, man, it's a blessing, and it's a privilege to be here. I love what you guys are doing, and yeah, it's an honor to be a part of it.
So for my listeners, can you tell them a little bit about yourself?
Right now, my background is I'm a minister and also a professor of church history and theology. And so I do ministry in our church here in an urban multi-ethnic context. And also I teach in different seminary contexts and colleges, Christian colleges. My background is primarily focusing on the history of Christianity in Africa, as well as other parts of kind of like the early global church. And my degree was from the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., in Egyptian and Semitic languages and literature. And also I studied at Princeton Seminary in church history, as well as Gordon Conwell Seminary in Boston, Massachusetts, where I got my Master of Divinity. And right now I'm teaching and writing primarily in that subject matter of early Christianity in Africa, which is my primary interest, and working on a book with InterVarsity Press that is going to be exploring the early growth of Christianity in Africa as well as Asia. And also I teach in various seminaries, in Eden Theological Seminary, Western Theological Seminary, but also I direct and work with an African-American seminary program called the Meacham Memhara Haymanot, or the Meacham School of Theological Institute, which is an African-American seminary program which is purposed to bring accredited theological education done by African-American Christian theologians and Bible scholars to the African-American community at an affordable and accessible rate. So you can learn more and check out more about that at www.meacham, that's MEACHUM.org.
All right. Well, listen, it sounds like you are a busy man.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of exciting things. Keep us all busy, ain't that right?
Good for you, and thank you so much for agreeing to be with us. Such an accomplished and distinguished professor, theologian, teacher, researcher. But we have a special person we want to talk about, and for a subject, I said he's a boy from the hood. His name is Saint Augustine. He is known as the father of the church. So listen, tell me a little bit about St. Augustine, and is he relevant today in an urban context?
That's a great question. Well, I'm so glad that you guys are talking about Augustine, and really, because obviously, you know, he's really one of the most, if not the most significant Christian writer in the history of Christianity, outside of a biblical writer like Paul or somebody like that. Really across the board, he's the most significant theologian in the history of the Christian tradition. And so then it goes without saying that he's the most significant Christian writer to ever come from the continent of Africa, and especially that he's from the early African period. And so I'm just so excited that you guys are talking about that, because we across the board need to really talk more about African history from the from that time period. We often, you know, really neglect that time period of kind of the late antique and the medieval time periods in African history. And that's when we really have so many great Christian theologians and figures. And of course, he's the most prominent one. And so yeah, I think that we know so much about his life, not only about his thought, but also we know details about his life because one of his most famous books was his Confessions, where he talks about his life growing up in the town of Tagaste, which is now called Souk Ahras in the eastern Algeria, modern day Algeria, but in his day it was called Numidia, and which is a Roman province of Africa, North Africa, of the Roman Empire. And he grew up in that city, and was born in the mid 300s. And we know so much about his life from that book of Confessions, where he talks about his life growing up in Tagaste, all the way up into his conversion and his becoming a bishop. But just a brief, very brief kind of overview of some of the things that he lays out in that book is that he was born there, and he was born to a Christian mother named Monica, as well as to a wealthy local politician named Patricius. And he was born and raised, especially, we know from his book that he had a very close relationship with his mother and that she was one of the primary influences on him. And she was a strong believer and prayed for him to know the Lord. And so I think that's, if I could kind of answer both questions at one time, that's, I think, an aspect of Augustine's life that very much connects with our community in the urban African-American community, is that so many of us, we grow up in contexts where we have very faithful and persevering mothers who pray for us and sow seeds into our lives that sometimes don't come to fruition until later in life. And even though Augustine's father, from what we can see, was around, he seems to have a pretty negative experience with his dad. But for Augustine's life growing up, his dad was prone to violence and also was not very present. But his mother was always there praying for him. And I think that's something many in our community can relate to. And Augustine has a very high estimation of his mother. The high regard we hold for mothers in our community is something that we can very much relate to, especially in community where, sometimes because of the situation, it's hard for fathers to be around or be present. And then he later on went over into Rome, and with his education, he began to teach. He taught in Carthage, and he also taught up in Rome, taught in the Greek rhetorical tradition, which was, the basic system of education in the Roman Empire, was learning rhetoric and logic. And then he actually ended up getting involved in a branch of, or kind of an offshoot of Christianity called Manichaeism, and Augustine was one of what they called the hearers.
So in a sense, it sounds like to me that Augustine was wilding out,
mm-hmm.
and then after he finished wilding out, he goes and gets religion, and he joins. He doesn't join the traditional church; he joins a cult. And because he's so gifted, like so many of our young people, he gets to be a leader in the cult.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, and now in the cult, how does he finally make it into the traditional church experience?
Well, I think that's a really great question, and it also connects again. I mean, I think even the point you just made is another great connection point, because, in our community, we have many cults today that also are very attractive to many of our young people, and they pull people into them away from kind of the traditional and the true teachings of Scripture and the church. We have many of them in our community, especially in a place like New York, many different very popular, cult groups like, the Manichaeans, who, come to young people who are wilding out and who are kind of drifting away, and they give them a sense of identity. And so Augustine was a part of it. But, Augustine, one thing about him is he always had a search for truth. And many of our young people are intelligent, deeply intelligent, and they search for truth. And if they continue to search for it, they will find it. the same thing happened for Augustine, because he became disenchanted with Manichaeism. He knew that it was not the truth. And then it wasn't until he went to the city of Milan and he was teaching rhetoric there as well that he met a person named Ambrose, who he had credited as his spiritual father, who was able to speak the truth of the gospel and the teachings of Scripture, that it just put Augustine in awe. But it was also the fact that Ambrose took Augustine under his wing and really discipled him. Because we have to remember, Augustine had a bad relationship with his father. His father was abusive. His father was not present in his life. And even though he had a loving mother, Augustine still needed that father figure. And the church provided that leadership role in Ambrose for Augustine, and he saw him as a father. And I think that we can also relate to that in our community, that many times, and I relate to this even in my own story, that many times our fathers, when they are not there for us, sometimes spiritual fathers in the church can be mentors and figures that come alongside our young men and women in very powerful ways. And it's the same thing that Jesus promised when he said that anyone who follows him will not fail to receive mothers and brothers and spiritual family members. And that's exactly what happened for Augustine.
That was Dr. Vincent Bantu, founder of Meacham Mahara Hemanot, talking about St. Augustine, a boy from the hood. You can hear the entire interview on our website at mediasanctuary.org or on our SoundCloud at Media Sanctuary SoundCloud.
For those of y'all just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Lavonia Mallory, and you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy, the Sanctuary.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Guy, what if your bones don't pick, but they're sore? Does that count?
I think any sour bone would actually be acceptable.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Just want to know. All right. Up next, we have Climate Matters with Kevin Bailey of High Peaks Solar, discussing his international work bringing clean water and clean power to people.
Welcome to Climate Matters. We are here speaking again with Kevin Bailey of High Peaks Solar. And we've covered some really interesting topics in terms of solar from a residential perspective, a commercial perspective, from the perspective of community solar, some great options and opportunities there. In this segment, we're going to broaden even further and look at some of the experience that Kevin has had internationally developing renewables projects and looking at some of the issues that apply to people worldwide in terms of energy and water quality issues. So welcome once again, Kevin. Thank you.
Thank you, Pete. Appreciate it.
Yeah, great to be here. So when did you first get this interest to think about issues internationally in terms of this environmental energy perspective?
Shortly out of college, a couple of years before I started my business, just hearing about some of the statistics of the number of people who were living without electricity and without clean water, I was in the middle of thinking about the energy picture in the United States and some of the overhaul that's necessary. And then I had a revelation of sorts that, we're talking about changing the type and source of some of our electricity. And meanwhile, there's people that never had it in the first place. Hmm. So, the sort of the forgotten folks. And so I felt compelled to turn those feelings into actions. So I filed to start a 501c3 public charity called The Sky Is Not Limited. And that was 2006. And the goal was to fundraise and find places that needed clean water and use solar electricity to pump, filter, move water for people.
So this is before you got your own company started, High Peaks. You started a not-for-profit to attack some of these issues and kind of follow your conscience.
Yeah, and so that led me to, looking back on the last 12, 13 years now, meet some really wonderful groups of people that are working. I've been to Haiti, I've been to East Africa, and have worked with groups to provide solar-powered water wells for irrigation, for drinking, for schools, and have traveled there to see a lot of the problems that they have in their day-to-day lives and how the solar technology can alleviate some of the, whether it be walking distances, you know, to get water and just, you know, cultivation of food and the requirements of needing water and how to, you know, set up, you know, sort of, you know, farms and just, I'm so grateful to have met people that have helped me put my vision and work with them into reality.
Gotcha. So can you kind of share with us a little bit of some recent examples of projects?
Sure.
To kind of get a picture of that?
Happy to. So in Tanzania, we're working with a group there called African Reflections Foundation. And they have started greenhouse growing and cultivation using water from the solar-powered wells. So there'll be above-ground 5,000-liter tanks and drip irrigation, and they're using that water to grow all sorts of neat foods. That organization is providing them with an outlet to sell those vegetables in the city. And they formed these women's groups. And my friend Maria Poole, who runs that foundation, has said that a lot of these women have never touched money in their whole life. And now that they have the ability to create an income and a food source for their family, it's this life-changing opportunity for them. And so that the most recent efforts that I've been a part of is these wells on these farms and greenhouses.
Interesting, East Africa and Tanzania. So I'm just curious, the reasoning for greenhouses. I mean, you're close to the equator. You've got lots of sun. I picture greenhouse needs being
right.
Upstate New York.
That's the same thing I thought when I went there. But the sun is so hot there, it's wilting the crops. And it's requiring a lot more water to grow in direct sunlight. So they found that growing it under this sort of, whether it be a mesh or an actual greenhouse with a different kind of mesh, I saw two different types of structures they built there, the plants are wilting less and require a little less water just with that partial shade. And so the sun there is actually is a liability as opposed to an asset in the grow. So, you know, it's a little, just something they learned, you know, over growing, you know, over the last couple of years and some of the things
gotcha.
They've seen.
So how big of an operation is this? Is this like 20 families or
so,
this example in Tanzania?
Yes.
What part of Tanzania was this?
This is about an hour south of Dar es Salaam in the Makaranga district. The first plot, I believe, was 30 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a couple similarly sized parcels within a few miles of that these projects are starting to bud up and take off, and it's quite something to see and witness.
So a lot of them are then this kind of a community level well, so you're not necessarily working with an individual family, mostly with a village or an organization?
So it's an actual company that African Reflections founder Maria Poole's started. It's called Tans Pro Green, so it's an organic vegetable business that she's sponsoring and giving women opportunity to get a job with a little bit of pay and then grow this food. So it's an actual business that's spun off from a nonprofit effort, and it's just. It's just magnificent.
Wonderful. So what other, are there other efforts that you've done in Tanzania, or did you want to jump to
Haiti? Yeah, just quickly went up to the northern part of Tanzania in Bukundi and found how dry it was there and how the water conditions. I moved from tropical to desert just within the same country there, and the water challenges there were so much greater. So I'm still looking for an answer to some of the high pH salt groundwater they have. And once I can solve that problem, I can be a part of some deep well projects and provide water through that. But I'm still in the learning stage of how to treat that water and what's cost effective and energy efficient to do that in such a remote place. So that was my takeaway and my challenge and homework after visiting that part of the country.
And you had mentioned, I believe it was that part of the country, kind of a compelling experience you had in showing up at a site one morning and meeting a couple of women there. So
I got to tour the outskirts of this small town, driving through, the bush, and we came upon a small town that I'll never be able to pronounce without looking at and studying a few times. But there, behind the town, there was a small, shallow well, and we pulled up in our car and we got out, and there was two women who had slept there from the night before with buckets, and they were waiting for some groundwater to trickle in this shallow well to be able to take home. And it was just one of those, heart-wrenching experiences to see, and it made me more energetic to get back and do more well. So it, within the vicinity of that area in a little rural place maybe a mile from there, we're going to construct another shallow well. The problem there is they're seasonal, so we really need to solve the deep well issue to treat that water.
And what do you actually mean by so the baseline of the well where these two women had waited overnight for the well to replenish, that one, how deep is that relative to what you call a shallow well compared to what you call a deep well?
Yeah, that's about 40 feet, and it's hand dug. We look to do the deep wells that are, 100 meters or 300 feet, where they're not susceptible to the dry season and drying up that deep typically.
Yep.
So they're
around. Well, we've been visiting with Kevin Bailey of High Peak Solar, and he's been describing some really motivating and impressive international work, and shared some other experiences. Clearly walking the walk and demonstrating that the Stone Age did not end because we ran out of stones. This is Climate Matters, and we thank Kevin Bailey for being a wonderful guest.
Thank you.
That was Peter Savio speaking with Kevin Bailey of High Peak Solar. Next, Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended a workshop on Saturday, February 16th at the New York State Black and Puerto Rican Legislators Weekend Caucus entitled Revolution or Reform at the Empire State Plaza. The workshop was sponsored and facilitated by State Assembly member Charles Barron. In this segment, you'll hear part two of his four-part report on the workshop, Revolution or Reform.
This is your Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry. In this segment, you will hear part two of my report from the New York State Black and Puerto Rican Legislative Caucus weekend on a workshop entitled Revolution or Reform. This workshop was facilitated by State Assembly Charles Barron. Revolution or Reform, Part 2.
Martin Luther King said, "For years I labored with the idea of reforming the existing institutions of the South. Reform. A little change here, a little change there. Now I feel quite differently. I think you've got to have a radical reconstruction of the entire society. A revolution of values." Give Martin Luther King a hand clap. They don't want you to know that, King. "I have a dream. Black boys and black girls on the mountaintops shaking hands." You know, they want you to have. Matter of fact, his "I Have a Dream" speech was first rendered at the Walk for Freedom in Detroit in June of 1963. He did "I Have a Dream" to 125,000 people in Detroit, black people. Then 2 months later, he did it in the Washington Monument, and it became popular. Let Dr. King speak for himself.
"We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice
give Dr. King a hand clap. You see, that's the Dr. King that they don't want you to know about. He said, I integrated the lunch counters, and now that you're sitting down for lunch, we don't have no money to pay for the lunch. So when he started fighting against capitalism, not just the war in Vietnam, the imperialism, when he started fighting against capitalism, that's when they felt he needed to die. And that's when J. Edgar Hoover did more surveillance of Dr. King than he did of my Black Panther Party. And what was Dr. King saying? We want to vote. We want to integrate. We want justice. You know, we were saying other kinds of things, but Dr. King should not have been murdered. Little baby girls bombed in the church for them, murdered a month after the I Have a Dream speech. You kill out four baby girls. And what they're trying to do, vote? What's the solution?
Revolution!
I want to introduce y'all to a man everybody knows. But I thought this nice little song that Miriam Makeba, she was a revolutionary freedom fighter in South Africa. And her daughter had written a nice song for her to sing for this gentleman that we all love and know.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Our next song was written for us by my little girl, who's not so little anymore. She's named Bongi. She wrote a song about a great man. I say a great man because it was a Black man who fought for liberation, for the liberation of Black people. Ladies and gentlemen, Malcolm X. Everybody seems to be preaching revolution.
Give Mary McCleaver a big hand clap. And I want to introduce y'all to my queen. Come on up here. The love of my life. This is my queen. And you know, a lot of brothers that get successful, you know, they if they don't go with a white woman, they'll try to find something closest to a white. I unmistakably got me a Black woman. There'll be no confusion. There'll be no confusion. And say happy birthday to Inez. Today's her birthday. Give her a big hand clap. Happy birthday, Inez. What's the solution?
Revolution!
Let's hear from Malcolm.
In order for you and me to devise some kind of method or strategy to offset some of the events or a repetition of the events that have taken place here in Los Angeles recently, we have to go to the root. We have to go to the cause. Dealing with the condition itself is not enough. We have to get to the cause of it all, or the root of it all.
See, once again, you see, Malcolm said, get to the root. The root causes. If we don't get to the root, and you know, you can do it simultaneously. It doesn't mean that you don't fight for reformist rights. It doesn't mean you don't fight for quality education and jobs and all of that. But you can't forget the root causes. And this is what Malcolm was trying to emphasize. There's another response that we had in the 60s, revolutionary nationalism. Malcolm was a revolutionary nationalist. You know, he wanted to get to the root causes. He was definitely against capitalism and imperialism, but he wanted us to own some land and have some independence for ourselves as well.
This is called nationalism.
when the brethren, the white men, became involved in a revolution in this country against England. What was it for? He wanted this land so he could set up another white nation. This white nationalism. The American Revolution was white nationalism. The French Revolution was white nationalism. The Russian Revolution too, yes, it was white nationalism. You don't think so? Why do you think Khrushchev and Mill can't get their heads together? White nationalism. All the revolutions that's going on in Asia and Africa today are based on what? Black nationalism. A revolutionary is a black nationalist. He wants a...
So that was one of the responses from some of our leaders in the 60s. Some wanted to integrate and wanted equality and justice. And some said, well, you know what? You don't want us. We don't want you. Let's separate. And we'll have our own nation. Let us control our own communities. Wherever we are the majority, this is what we're trying to do in East New York. If we are the majority in a community, we should own the land. Mm-hmm. We should own all of the businesses.
Yes. Right.
We should own the social and cultural institution, especially the police.
Yes. Yes.
That should be who we want to police us and how we want to be police. We should own the hospitals. Mm-hmm. You can't come in our communities. We are colonies. We are a colony.
Yeah.
We have the majority of the people in the community, but we don't own nothing. How do we go in the 21st century making more money than we've ever made before? And how do you own nothing when right after slavery, we had Tulsa, Little Africa, the bourgeoisie called it Black Wall Street later, Little Africa, where they owned everything, oil wells, they owned it, everything, every social, the land. How do we have Rosewood? Right after slavery, we owned everything. Wilmington, right after slavery, we owned everything. We get in the 21st century and we own nothing. What's the solution?
Revolution!
I want to talk to you about my party, the Black Panther Party. Give the Panthers a big hand clap for what they've done in history. When I was 18 years old, living on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, I was starting a whole lot of trouble, and I saw some Panthers came down, and Mark Holder recruited me. I wasn't in the leadership. Nobody knew me or nothing like that. But we used to go up to Harlem and get our papers and sell our papers. We fought to free Angela Davis. I'll explain her in the future, in the near future in this. But the Black Panther Party was one of the most revolutionary, productive organizations we've ever had. And it went beyond picking up guns and following police. You know, that's what they want you to think. That's the only thing they did. Let me show you the stuff that they did. They wanted to end police brutality. I'm going to show you the 10-point program after this
is finished. Please not to, in our community,
Huey P. Newton, give him a big hand clap.
Because this
we united with other groups, American Indian movement, Palestinians, Mexicans, Latinos, young lords. Thousands of people ate meals, free health clinics,
tuition free school. We did what the government would not do, and they were absolutely afraid and said we were the most dangerous, the most threatening to the internal security of the United States. As the party grew, we were more and more stalked and surveilled by the FBI.
Give our sisters a hand clap. The women were powerful in the Black Panther Party.
Revolution or Reform, Part 2.
Hudson Mohawk. That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Roaming correspondent Willie Terry at the New York State Black and Puerto Rican Legislators Caucus Weekend, attending a workshop entitled Revolution or Reform. Up next, we have the Spirit of the Suffragettes Summer Concert Series and Community Resource Fair will be launching alongside the 7th Annual Freedom Festival on Saturday, June 8th from 3 to 6 p.m. and then will be held at Freedom Square every Tuesday at 4 to 7 p.m. from July 16th through August 20th. And the closing with the 9th annual Story Harvest Celebration in September. Up next is Cassidy McCabe, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent with Cherokee Grimes, the Community Engagement Coordinator for WMHT, to discuss the needs for women and mothers and the Spirit of the Suffragette Summer Festival.
In anticipation for the Spirit of the Suffragette Festival that will take place this summer at Freedom Square, we'll be looking at how the history of women's suffrage has impacted the present day and what sorts of social justice work can be done to move forward. Cherokee, what kind of issues of today do you think parallel the suffragette movement?
Well, thank you for inviting me. I think that one of the big issues is birth justice, and currently I am 6 months pregnant. Mm-hmm. I just started a new job at WMHT, and because I started a new job, I won't be able to take the New York State Paid Family Leave Act, which pays for about half of your salary mm-hmm. while you're on leave. So my maternity leave is now sort of something I have to think about. How I'm going to be able to do the things that I normally do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like trying to balance work and family is, I can imagine, hard.
Yeah. So one option is the Disability Act, which it pays only about $170 per week. Mm-hmm. And so for a mother living in today's modern society, mm-hmm. it's very difficult to take care of a child or even yourself on that.
I don't think that doesn't amount. Sound like it's enough to take care of a kid.
No.
Or even yourself.
So luckily for me, I have a partner who will be supporting me. Mm-hmm. But in this time, I'm thinking about women who are maybe single mothers or mm-hmm. who don't have other resources, family or friends who can help them, and mm-hmm. how difficult it would be to take care of themselves and their babies.
Yeah, definitely. So you advocate for single mothers sort of thing?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. What drives your passions?
Currently, it's because of my current situation, but I think just supporting and empowering women in our community mm-hmm. is really important, and knowing that not all women have the same opportunities that maybe I mm-hmm. have or that other women have.
Yeah, definitely. What historical figure can you think of that inspires you in the work you do?
So one historical figure that really inspires me is Nina Simone. Mm-hmm. She's not completely directly related to the work that I'm currently doing, but I'm really inspired by her ability to just tell her story mm-hmm. and be herself as she was throughout her whole life through her music. And I also play piano, so I aspire to be like her. I'm not as good as Nina Simone, but...
Yeah. Do you know what kind of work she did?
So she did a lot of work through her music, through her mm-hmm. lyrics in the civil rights movement. And you can see sort of a progression in her music and becoming more of an activist.
Mm. Yeah, I love when musicians mix activism with their music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good when you can use something that you're passionate mm-hmm. about to do good.
Yeah, a platform.
Mm-hmm.
How would you say our social rights movements have changed in relation to the suffragette movement?
So a lot of things haven't changed, unfortunately. I think that media is a big influence in how it has changed with, mm-hmm. we see with the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. That becoming really big on social media and other online channels. And I think that that's something that was a little difficult for the suffragettes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not having that method of communication.
Mm-hmm. It definitely, with addition of social media, it definitely opened the floodgates of like so yeah. much more voices being heard.
Definitely.
Versus just white women being heard.
That's true. That's another good point.
For those just tuning in, I'm speaking with Cherokee, the community engagement coordinator from WMHT, in honor of the Spirit of the Suffragette Festival that's taking place this summer. What qualities would you say a person needs in order to be considered a modern day suffragette?
I think that they have to have a goal.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think without a goal, you're not as driven to accomplish something specific. And I think that they would just need to have the passion. We know that not all the suffragettes received the support they needed, mm-hmm. But they kept moving on towards their goal. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the same definition that we can adopt today.
Yeah. Definitely. It's definitely needed to have passion.
Yeah.
Would you consider yourself a modern suffragette?
I think I would have some more work to do mm-hmm. to consider myself a modern day suffragette, but it's definitely something to aspire to.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely have goals for women and thinking about mothers in particular, mm. but I think I could be doing more work towards that goal.
Yeah. If you were to nominate someone as a suffragette, who would you nominate and why?
So on my way to and from work, I'm always listening to podcasts, and mm. I really love listening to different shows, but Jenna Wortham, who is a culture writer at the New York Times, is someone who I would nominate because she just has this fire and passion and is really focused on specifically lifting up Black women or women of color
mm-hmm.
and non-binary women, and thinking about her position at the New York Times and mm-hmm. how she's using that as, like you said, a platform
yeah.
is also really inspiring.
Yeah, that's so important. I love that.
Yeah.
Can you think of anyone you know personally who could be a suffragette in your eyes?
I would say one of my best friends. Her name is Summer.
Mm.
She actually reminds me a lot of Jenna Wortham. But she works towards women's rights, specifically reproductive rights. And so everything that she does is really geared towards that goal.
That's great. Thank you for your time, Cherokee. For more information about this upcoming Women's Resource Fair and Summer Festival, please visit tinyurl.com/suffragettespirit. Thank you for listening to this week's piece on the spirit of the suffragettes.
Thank you.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Cassidy McCabe speaking with Cherokee Grimes, the community engagement coordinator for WMHT, to discuss the needs for women and mothers and the spirit of the Suffragettes Summer Festival.
Guy, guess what?
Oh, no.
That concludes our show.
Already?
Mm-hmm. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I am Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Guy, are you going to do your riddle?
Yes, yes. Okay, so the riddle for this week is: critics do it, cooks use it, the Greeks revere it, it is all-encompassing. Again, critics do it. Cooks use it. The Greeks revere it. It is all-encompassing.
And if you're listening out there, you can email us the answer at mediasanctuary.org. Steve is going to love it. As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering at our radio, in our radio efforts, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday night at 7:07 p.m. That's 7:07 p.m. right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.